Where Murder Meets Mystery contains graphic and explicit content. Listener discretion is advised. Hey, ghoul friends. Let's take a walk down the street where Murder Meets Mystery, a podcast exploring the murderous, the mysterious, and everything that lies beyond the beyond. I'm Grace.
And I'm Trevor.
And Trevor's having some eye problems.
I don't know. I got a new monitor, so it's probably brighter than I'm used to.
It is brighter than the sun, I have to say.
It's nice.
Trevor looks bathed in ethereal light.
Yeah, bathed in ethereal light. There's worse things that could happen to you, to be honest.
So true. Hey, so we are recording this post-Thanksgiving. How was your Thanksgiving, Trev?
It was great. I had Thanksgiving at my uncle's house for my family, like my side of the family, and then we had Thanksgiving on Saturday with like both sets of our parents, so Scarlett's parents, my parents, and then our sister Molly, and that was super fun. I had a great time. Thanksgiving at my house was more fun than I thought it was going to be.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's good. I love...
How was your Thanksgiving, Grace?
Oh my god, my Thanksgiving was ass. Let me tell you guys about it. So, I got COVID. COVID finally caught up with me, man. I've been running... Trev's still a COVID
person. And then there was one podcast host who hasn't had COVID.
Trevor's never had it. Man, it only took me down for like 3 days, but the problem was that I just kept testing positive until... yesterday. Friday was my first negative test. So anyway, I got to see some people. Thursday, I did a very distance Thanksgiving. I didn't get to eat with my family, which really sucked. I just kind of sat on the deck until it got dark. And then they were like, the turkey's ready. And I had to leave. It was just really, it was really fucking depressing.
Yeah. You don't sound bad.
No, I'm still a little like congested and just kind of yucky, but I'm not contagious anymore, which is good.
Yeah, it is good.
Yeah, I just kind of feel like how you're on the tail end of a cold and you sound kind of like that.
Bleh.
And so Saturday we had kind of like my family and I got together and decorated for Christmas, and then I got to see Max today, my boyfriend. So yay. That was nice. And now we're here. Now I got to see my buddy Trev.
And what up?
Yeah, and I'm glad to be back and back in action. And
Hopefully you don't have a lot of COVID brain moments, but it will just.
I am. I'll be honest. Like I'm having a few. Oh, first of all, let me tell you what one of my students said.
Mm-hmm.
So rude. Oh my god. I was like. Oh, I forgot something that he had told me. And I was like, yeah, it's COVID brain. I've been having some like
memory problems. How dare you forget?
Right. And I've been having memory problems legitimately. Like, I think it's a COVID thing. But I'll have moments where I'm just in the middle of a sentence and I'll trail off and completely forget what I was saying. Or I'll have word location problems where I'm like trying to find the word for something and I can't think of it. It's a little alarming. I'm pretending it's not happening. Anyway. I told my student, I was like, oh, I've been having some memory issues. I think it's COVID. And he said, that sounds like more of an age problem.
Dang. It's funny. How old do you think I am, young man, young lady?
I was so fucking mad. Oh, yeah. Trev had a birthday. Let's talk about your birthday.
Oh, yeah, yeah. My birthday was recent, November 23rd.
How was your birthday?
It was good. Basically just kicked it at home, went out to eat at a restaurant. It was kind of, redacted. Redacted. Yeah.
Okay.
We went out to eat at a restaurant, and it was like an Italian restaurant, and it was it wasn't that good. It wasn't.
Really?
It was kind of like a dorm, not like dining hall restaurant.
Yeah.
Italian food.
Like a K&W.
Like runny spaghetti, la marinara, like runny marinara on like spaghetti.
Marinara. Have you ever been to Cece's Pizza? Is it like that?
Yeah, it's buffet style. It's probably pizza. Like that. It tasted like buffet style Italian food.
Yeah.
But it was like priced at like Olive Garden prices, and at that point, probably should have just went to Olive Garden.
Right. Exactly. And even Olive Garden is, it's expensive for what it is, I feel like.
Yeah, and we only read, so we didn't read the reviews because this place just opened up, and I was like, well, let's go try it. Why not? You know, it's in your hometown, so you're like, let's go eat. And after we got done, we read the reviews, and we had just got done talking about how we should have just went to Olive Garden if we knew what that was. And one of the reviews was like, the only one that was truthful was like, this isn't that good, y'all. Like, we could just go to Olive Garden and get better food and stuff. But and all the other reviews were like, this is the best Italian food I've ever had. And I was like, that's a stretch. Like,
well, that they do that sometimes, marketing, even though mm-hmm. technically
I was like, sounds like a paid review.
Yeah. It's well, they or they'll just they'll have like employees, which I guess still is a paid review. They'll have employees post reviews. Right. Yeah.
It was chaos though, because speaking of dropping glass and silverware and all that stuff at the Italian restaurant, the owner was walking around with like a fake looking beer, but like it was realistic. And he was just like, whoa, would like spill it, but not like, it's not real.
So it was
it's
like
not
a liquid. Gag?
Yeah. It's like solid. But it looks like a beer's gonna fall over on your table.
That's so
and like
weird.
He does it in like full view of me, and I don't recoil or react. I'm just kind of like, I just kind of smile and look at him, and I don't know why I didn't like have a normal reaction to that, and why I was just like such a, like a stone cold like psychopath to him. But he was like, and then kind of went away.
Oh, that's so awkward. He said, Michael Scott,
Mamma Mia. Type. Said Mamma Mia when he did it.
No. Does he seem Italian?
He seemed Italian.
Okay. God, that's but so weird.
It was very strange. And our waiter had brought the table next to us food that wasn't their order. Uh-huh. And so they didn't start eating it yet. And he immediately went over there and was like, hey, don't eat that. Don't eat that. It's not yours.
Yeah, that's a health code violation. Once the food
Yeah, but
the
he
table,
put it on the table.
Can't. Yeah, once and, the food hits the table, you can't reserve it. Yeah,
I think he might have reserved it.
Oh, that's like an immediate, like, you lose a full point for that.
Yeah, well, they lost a full point.
Yeah, yikes.
Their food lost a whole another full point.
Should have just gone to Olive Garden.
Yeah.
All right, hey, Trent, you know. You ready to get into it?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, cool. Today's case has everything, okay? We've got some murder. We've got some kidnapping. We've got some unsolved mystery.
Interesting.
We've got some haunting.
That's mine.
Yep. Make sure your light is on, by the way.
No, but that's mine. No, you can't do that.
This is a haunting that uncovers a murder, so it's very...
It's where murder meets mystery. You're the murderer of the mystery. Come on.
Yeah,
step
whatever.
Step off my turf, bro.
You're like, stay in your lane, bitch.
No, I don't care. That'd be cool. No,
okay, so this our story stars this woman named Jodie Foster. I'm not kidding. That's her name.
Oh, not the Jodie Foster.
Not the Jodie Foster, not Silence of the Lambs Jodie Foster, where she's like, it's very insightful, doctor, but can you turn that high powered perception on yourself?
I always thought that was a voice that she does.
No, that's her real voice.
It's wild. It's
your accent is pure West Virginia.
Yeah, it's off putting.
Yeah, that's her. No, that's her real voice. That's what she sounds like.
It's off putting, is what it is.
Also, for those of you who don't know who Jodie Foster is, Marissa, bitch, I'm talking to you because I know you don't know who that is. Listen, that's a great Jodie Foster impression. I'm very proud of myself.
Yeah,
isn't that good?
It sounds good.
I would say that's more than decent. Anyway,
this
is not the Jodie Foster. This is.
If I was blindfolded and in the dark, I'd be like, is that Jodie Foster? Why is she here?
What? Am I recording this podcast with Jodie Foster right now?
Yeah, like if Jodie Foster tied me up and threw me in a prison and talked to me, I'd say you would match that about 9 out of 10. After a while, though, probably like a couple days in captivity, I'd be like, this isn't Jodie Foster. It's
not. Something's gone terribly awry.
I know Jodie Foster.
I know my Foster. This ain't no Foster. Okay, listen. So this is it's an imposter. This is not the real. This is the imposter Foster.
It's a Foster imposter.
It's an imposter.
Yeah. And now we've lost her.
Now we've lost her.
We've lost our audience. Okay. Next.
So this is the real. No, this is not the real the actress Jodie Foster. This is another Jodie Foster. But she was
loving that one sentence in, and we're already just like riffing too much. All right.
Literally a bullet point. My bullet point is four words. It's single mom, Jodie Foster, and we've been riffing on it. Oh my God. Okay, so she was born in Orange County, California.
Uh-huh.
And she was a single mom to a beautiful baby girl named Hannah, who was born in 1997. Jodie
Hannah with an H?
Hannah with an H. Two H's.
Oh.
All Hannahs start with an H.
Hannah with two H's. Sorry.
So, she gave birth to Hannah in 1997, and she decided they needed a new start, fresh start, new leash on life, whatever. Lease on life. Leash? Did I just say leash? Oh, my God.
Yeah, leash. Lease like, on life. And fresh start is a... Okay. Whoa. This is going to be a fun one.
Oh, God. Yeah, I decided it'd be fun to try crack before we recorded today. So that's what's going on with that.
Krovid.
Yeah. Krovid. Krakovid.
Krakovid.
Oh, God. Okay, so they moved to the town of Chico, California. Okay. Cool. Jodie says this was a quaint, beautiful town, and it felt like home. She found the perfect apartment. A complex. It's called Walnut Garden Apartments. Okay. And she found an apartment for rent number 14 and decided it was the perfect place for her and her daughter. Hannah was 3 and Jodie was 33 at the time. Now, Jodie later in this episode, by the way, I got this from Unsolved Mysteries, endless source of content, by the way. But this was one of the newer episodes that they just released on Netflix. And Jodie later in the episode explains, like, Jodie's a kind of a weird chick, like you can tell, like she definitely believes in some extra supernatural shit. You know what I mean? Like she just has that look about her.
Is it like like a natural or like a hippie person?
Yes.
Or is
like
it
she's a little bit of a hippie, kind of new agey.
Kind of has crystals.
Like she for sure has crystals. Yeah.
Okay.
And so, I mean, I loved her, by the way. She seems like a cool person. But she said that she believes certain people are born with just like a higher... She didn't call herself psychic, even though some of these things are kind of... It's described how psychics like help on cases and stuff like that. But she... And some of the things are like super uncanny that she like pieces together. But she doesn't describe herself as a psychic or even having ESP or anything like that. But she just says, I think certain people are tuned into that frequency and certain people are not. Just like they how they say dogs and babies can sense ghosts and adults can't always, you know? Like I think she just kind of, some people have that capacity. So she said the minute they walked into the apartment, the vibes were off, okay? She says that as they were moving in, she felt not at peace and she had this feeling of what she describes as impending doom. Like the apartment was unsafe and she uses the word just dark. There was like a dark presence. So she said the first thing she noticed was it had a really bizarre smell. Like it was kind of like a chemical smell, which is interesting because usually demons are described as like smelling like sulfur. That's usually what people smell as. Sulfur, but
sulfuric,
not that she really runs into a demon, but supernatural beings give off these odors. Regardless, she was ready to start a happy life for her and her daughter when she said, quote, shit hit the fan. Strange and inexplicable things began to happen around the apartment. One of the first occurrences that Hannah and her mother recall involves a pair of shoes. At the time, Hannah owned a pair of little pink sneakers, which her mom always kept by the door so she could get ready quickly and get out the door. One day, they couldn't find the sneakers anywhere. And then suddenly, Hannah recalls, as if out of nowhere, the sneakers appeared neatly next to each other in the center of her bed. Just like sitting on her bed.
All right.
Jodie was convinced at the time that Hannah had moved them and was just kind of playing a joke on her. She was 3 at the time. So she was convinced that Hannah was lying and had moved them. But then this became a daily occurrence. She would move the shoes back, sometimes even in the morning. And then, like, she would go into the kitchen while Hannah was still asleep and come out. And they were sitting next to Hannah, who was asleep.
It's weird.
Like, very strange. So,
like, did this chemical smell, like, at any point, was she, like, and maybe getting ahead of myself, was she, like, am I hallucinating because of the chemicals I'm smelling?
Interesting. That's a good question.
Because, like, okay, yeah, it's not sulfur. Like that, where it's not like an
environmental,
like,
thing, yeah.
Yeah, it's not like a, it, sure, sulfur could be poltergeist or
she said it,
apparitions or ghosts, but at this point, it's like, are you all right? Like, because you might just be, like, smelling
industrial cleaner.
Yeah, like ammonia?
But she didn't mention it that it was, like, a lingering smell. She just mentioned it that when she first came in. It was, like, something she noticed. Yeah, I don't know how
she
important
might have got
it
used
is
to it and then just, like, got maybe high as balls every single day.
So day after day, Jody would move the shoes and they would reappear in the exact same spot on Hannah's bed. Things only got stranger from there. Jody recalls a set of salt and pepper shakers. Salt and pepper shakers, which, like, most people who, where do most people keep salt and pepper in their kitchen on the table?
On,
like,
the
where
table?
Is it on the table?
It's in the center.
Right. Okay. So she would keep salt and pepper in the center of the table, and then she would come in the morning, come into the kitchen, and the salt and pepper was sitting on, like, the edge of the table. It'd be, like, almost hanging off where it would fall.
Oh,
and it would be, like, in a really weird place, and it kept
happening.
Yeah,
like she had a cat.
Kind of, but the cat would knock shit over. They're not, like, strategically pushing them to the edge. Yeah, no. So the salt and pepper shakers. Then this became a daily occurrence, like the shoes. Shortly after this, after Jody and Hannah had moved in, Jody began to have unexplainable dreams, and this is where things get, like, kind of freaky.
Weird.
So she recalls a recurring dream in which a girl was walking down a street in Chico. She would move up the street and then be stopped by what Jody describes as a weird couple in a light blue or gray car who asked if she wanted a ride. At this point in the dream, a man would approach the girl from behind and place something over her mouth, and then Jody would wake up. And this kept happening. Just like she didn't recognize the girl, she didn't recognize the couple, just like a really weird dream.
But the recurring thing was,
it was the same event. And it was
almost
almost as if she was seeing it from above, she says, like an aerial view, kind of. Yeah, but she could describe the woman in rather vivid detail.
Okay, kind of like an out-of-body experience.
Exactly, yeah. One day, Jody was in the kitchen and Hannah was playing in the hallway. Jody heard her daughter very clearly say, "Hi!" Fuck that, right there. I'm moving
love
out.
It.
Hate it. When Jody asked who Hannah was saying hi to, Hannah replied, "That girl right there, Mom." Mm. And so Jody said, "Did she walk by the window?" And Hannah was adamant that the girl was right there and was wearing a white shirt.
Well, good.
Hannah remembers seeing this girl all the time. And this was like a very vivid, and they kind of just chalked it up to an imaginary friend, even though Jody, I think, is a believer in the supernatural.
Yeah, imaginary friends are weird.
Yeah. So Hannah remembers seeing the girl in vivid detail. She described her as a white girl, long, curly brown hair. She always was wearing a white shirt. And Hannah named her My Liz. Okay. So I want you to remember that name, My Liz. In another instance, Hannah and Jody went out and returned to find the receiver from the wall phone had been moved to another room, and all the toys in Hannah's room had been moved into a pile in the center of her room. Most alarmingly, Hannah had a favorite toy, a talking Ernie doll, Ernie from Sesame Street.
Yeah.
Ernie had been placed carefully on top of the pile of toys with a shoelace fastened into a noose around his neck.
Oh, come on.
Right? How have they not moved out by now? This is all within the first month.
I'm feeling like squatter, like someone living in the walls, like moving shit.
That's what I'm saying. It's like very specific. So
you're telling me a ghost tied a noose around Ernie's neck?
I was really skeptical, but just hang in there.
No,
I'm a skeptic.
I'm hanging.
Okay.
I'm hanging.
So Jody and Hannah immediately fled the apartment, called Chico police. Police take the report, but Jody says she felt like they for sure thought she was insane.
Yeah. Well, I'm feeling that way now.
The strange events come to a dramatic climax on February of 2000. Jody wakes in the middle of the night and hears static coming from the living room TV, full volume. It's like super, super loud. And this is a common occurrence with people who encounter the supernatural in their home. It's they communicate through TVs and computers and stuff like that. Yeah. All the electricity starts going haywire.
Have you ever had a TV on like the static like turn on in the middle of the night?
No.
Maybe like back when, we had yeah. like rear projection TVs and stuff.
I had a TV with a with an antenna in my when I was a kid. I had this TV and our we had a TV yeah. in like our game room.
I would wake yeah. up sometimes and my TV would be on, not with static like the noise. Yeah. But I would wake on from the light and it would just be stuck on a channel that we didn't have, or it would be stuck on a channel that right. So yeah, like haunted, on a different source. For
sure. Yeah.
Maybe. But
no, that's all I need to know.
I always wondered about how like how it turned itself on.
Yeah. Well, there's a ghost for sure.
I guess so.
Yep. May God have mercy on your soul. Anyway.
Well, but not my current house or anything. That's like growing up. But it's hard to explain why that would happen.
Yeah. These are things that you just don't have an explanation.
Yeah.
So she wakes in the middle of the night, hears static coming from the living room TV. Also, and this is all happening in rapid succession, okay? So the TV turns on. She walks out, she hears the static when she wakes up, comes out, sees the TV's on. Then the cupboards in the kitchen start flapping open and shut.
Woo!
Okay? And then she looks into the kitchen. It's like it's almost like the ghost was trying to get her attention. She turns to the kitchen and she sees the burners turn on high.
Nice.
Terrifying. As Jody is piecing together what she's seeing, she hears a noise coming from Hannah's bedroom. Hannah's still asleep for some reason. It's important to note here that the Ernie doll I mentioned earlier was a talking toy that children play with. Okay.
This particular
toy was programmed to utter the phrase, "I feel great," along with other greeting phrases. Sure enough, Jody heard the Ernie doll, which had been put away in the closet, begin to speak. "I feel great. I feel great. I feel great." Like it kept repeating like crazy.
Like a bad dubstep song.
Mm-hmm. I feel great. Yeah. Anyway. So Jody takes the batteries out of the doll to stop it from talking. And they run over to they actually go back to sleep at this point. Okay.
Oh, classic.
Which I'm like, I would have left after the first thing. But not even an hour later, Hannah wakes up and she hears the Ernie doll, now battery free, singing "Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star" from the top shelf of the closet.
Nice.
Which I'm just like, oh my God. Jody obviously loses her shit, and she was sleeping with Hannah in the room when suddenly all the lights in the apartment turn on at once, along with the TV, along with the stove burner, and the cabinets begin opening and closing again. Jody doesn't know what else to do, so she goes to the apartment manager who lives next door, and the manager runs after her and brings her dog. Okay. So when they arrive, the dog jumps out of the manager's arms and starts barking like crazy. At which point the cord to one of the lamps, so like you see behind me, or you can't really see it, but if this lamp was like pulled away, the cord kind of hangs in like a U shape, right?
Yeah.
The cord to one of the lamps starts moving around like a jump rope, is how Jody describes it.
Gotcha.
Around 6 o'clock in the morning, this is the next morning, Jody is sitting by the apartment pool with Hannah and she's just crying because she doesn't know what else to do. Obviously, the police aren't going to respond to anything like this because she's like, once like the burner and the TV start, it's just like, what is going on?
Yeah.
An older neighbor of Jody's approaches her, and this is a man who's lived there for about 25 years. He was walking his dog by the pool and told Jody that in the time he's lived there, nobody had inhabited her apartment for very long. And she says, "Please tell me why." And he says there was a girl who lived in apartment number 14 who has been missing ever since. So we're going to talk about this girl and the connection kind of.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So this is 24 years earlier. On January 31st, 1976, the Chico Police Department received a missing persons report for a young woman named Marie Elizabeth Spanicky. Now, okay. Marie Elizabeth went by a nickname, Mar Liz. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, My Liz. Or not, yeah. Mar Liz.
Yeah. That gives me chills every time.
That's super, like, weird. God. Did they solve this case?
They like, it's one of those, like, we basically know what happens. They just don't, it's frustrating because they don't have any physical evidence, but there's
like a body of evidence.
Correct. There's no body. And we'll talk about, yeah, what happened. So this guy, by the way, is up there with Ariel Castro, like fucking crazy.
Wow.
So Marie Elizabeth, or I'll refer to her as Marla's, that was her nickname. Her boyfriend had reported her missing after the two had gone to a flea market that Saturday and had gotten into a fight. Marla's had chosen to walk home rather than get a ride home from him. She was last seen walking down Mangrove Avenue and was not seen after that. Marla's was from a large family and had grown up in Cleveland, Ohio. She was outgoing and friendly. She had long, curly brown hair and light blue eyes, which is exactly, by the way, how Hannah described her. But they're not putting two and two together yet.
Not yet, yeah.
Not yet. So in 1975, Marla's worked with a man named John Baruth, and the two fell in love. And this was still in Cleveland. She decides to follow John when he moves back to California. And she was excited to pursue her dream of becoming an actress, which is very cliche, but that was her dream. However, California was not what she expected. And I would guess that Chico was probably smaller than the big city she had dreamed of. Yeah. And she wrote to her sister, speaking of small arguments with John and talking about her disheartened feelings about California, eventually announcing to her sister in a letter that she would be coming home in April of 1976. By 1977, the case had gone cold. And obviously, she disappeared at the end of January of 1976. So she had announced to her sister that she was going to be moving 3 months later. Or 2 months later. By 1977, the case goes cold. Back in the year 2000, Jody's dreams grew more bizarre. Okay. Jody continues to see the same weird couple and the same young woman with auburn hair, long auburn hair that's curly. Again, they're not connecting the two cases because they know this girl went missing, but Jody doesn't really look into it any further. Over time, the dream grows more vivid, and Jody recalls seeing the couple and the teenage girl and what she describes as a root cellar that resembles a dungeon. There was a large logging hook, and the girl was hung from the ceiling on the hook. Her arms were bound, and Jody saw the couple doing what she describes as creepy and sexually sadistic things to the girl.
Ew.
So Jody says she's still haunted and is being treated for PTSD just from the nightmares, so she can't imagine what this girl went through. So Jody is still haunted by the fear she felt in that apartment and made the decision to leave the Walnut Grove apartment after just 3 months. Jody begins dating a man. They move to another apartment in Chico. She begins dating a man who at the time was reading a true crime book about a series of abductions in the 1970s called Perfect Victim. When Jody recounted to the man the haunting stories of her time in apartment 14, he confirmed the story of Marla's disappearance from Chico in 1976, as he had discovered an article about it while doing research about this true crime book, which he's like us. Maybe we should ask him to co-host.
Yeah.
Jody calls Hannah, and Hannah by this time is a lot older. She's a teenager.
Yeah.
And she tells Hannah and shares the article with her. And when Hannah sees the picture of Marla's, Jody says she'll never forget it because Hannah was like, that's the girl from the apartment.
Oh, wow.
And that gives me...
It's so weird.
Look at, like... look at those chills. Man, that freaks me out.
She's all bumpy.
Right, because she had no way of knowing. Hannah was, like, at this point, I think, 15.
Yeah, she was just interacting with the ghost.
God.
It's weird.
It's just insane. And she, like, they even show on the Unsolved Mysteries episode, which, girlfriends, I recommend that you watch it. The show just keeps getting better, I have to say. But... they show Hannah's drawings from when she was a child, and like it looks like the girl, and it's just like her hair and the outfit that she was wearing when she disappeared. Fucking wild.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I want to see how she correlates the dream. I'm sure you're going to get to that.
Yes, I will. So Jody begins to investigate the disappearance because she believes that Marla's had been trying to communicate with her daughter. Cause she was like, rather than being like, that's fucking weird and dropping it, Jody is a fucking down bitch. And she was like, you know what?
She's like, maybe ghosts are real.
Trying to tell us something, right? Yeah. So let's find out what it is. We owe it to her. And I love that part. So she learns that Marla's disappearance was connected to a couple in Red Bluff, California, which is about 40 miles north of Chico. In November of 1984, Al Shamblin, I know we're jumping around a little bit. So
it's okay.
Marla's goes missing in 1976.
Yep.
The Fosters are in the apartment in 2000. And now we're in the middle of those two events. In November of 1984, Al Shamblin, who was the chief of Chico police at the time, was dispatched to a local church. A woman named Janice Hooker was sitting there with the pastor, and she was extremely emotional and upset. She reveals to Detective Shamblin that in 1976, her husband, Cameron Hooker, had kidnapped and killed a girl from Chico, California.
Oh, wow.
The detective reads Janice her rights. She lawyers up and refuses to speak without an attorney. The detective calls the DA, and after a series of negotiations and the DA hearing the information, he basically grants Janice immunity for the crime, because with the severity of the crime, they think that she's an asset to finding Cameron Hooker and prosecuting him.
Right. They're going to use her, and for her cooperating, then they're going to lessen her charge.
She's, of course, willing to talk. After this, Detective Shamblin was able to interview Janice, at which point Janice gives him the name of the victim, Marla's Spanicky.
Wow. So
the same girl. She says, this is Janice's account. She says that on January 31st, 1976, she and Cameron Hooker had seen Marla's walking on Mangrove Avenue, which is where she disappeared from. Janice claims this was a planned abduction, and they had circled the block several times after spotting her on the sidewalk. They offer Marla's a ride. It's the 70s, so she gets in. They begin to question her. Cameron had been looking for a girl with few ties to the community, and so they were kind of interrogating her, like, where are you from? Who do you know here? That kind of thing. Like,
premeditated. Sure.
She obviously grows suspicious and tries to get out of the car.
Yeah.
Cameron holds a knife to her throat and forces her back into the car, pushing a rag over her face. This is exactly, shot for shot, the dream that Jody had.
Right.
This is 24 years later. It gives me chills. It's so uncanny. So he puts her into something called a head box. And I didn't upload this to the drive, but I'm going to send you a picture.
Ew.
And I have a description.
I don't like the way it sounds.
Yeah. So this is literally just a picture of my TV. Essentially, girlfriends, a head box is a wooden box. It's like kind of the size of a milk crate. And it's lined with layers of styrofoam or soundproofing foam. And it's on a hinge. So the wearer is rendered basically mute and also deaf. So they can't.
It's basically like a wooden box filled with all sorts of like foam and stuff in it.
Yeah. So he puts this head box on her and puts her in the back of the car so she can't hear. She can scream all she wants. No one is going to hear her.
Yeah. Basically. It's basically like a gag and a blind and
exactly
all the above,
all in one.
But just a big box on your head.
Yeah. So they drive about 40 miles to the couple's home in Red Bluff. Janice says they pulled up to the garage behind the house. It was a detached garage. They parked the car inside the garage. Cameron then drugs Marla's with starting fluid poured on a rag, and he and Janice carry her from the house into the basement of the main house that was used primarily as a root cellar, which is exactly what Jody describes the basement as being. She thought it was a root cellar.
So he basically drugged her with ether is what starting fluid is.
Correct. Janice reports that Cameron had kidnapped Marla's with the full intention of making her a sex slave, that he had a pattern of.
What is this? Why is what?
It's and, insane.
What
this
is she
insane.
Doing? Why is she down with this? Okay, go ahead.
But okay, so like, I will. I'll explain. And this really changed my perspective about Janice, and I'll get to it. But it's not unprecedented that there are couples that commit atrocities like Ariel Castro.
Yeah.
And like,
well, I mean, there are bad women just as there are bad men. Or,
absolutely. I mean, but you know, also
it happens, but
you can assume that when a man is doing this to women, he's probably doing it to his wife as well.
Yeah.
Right.
I could
or
say
like,
so, yeah.
There's no way that he can hide that level of monstrosity from his you know, right. Not everyone's as psychopathic and high functioning as like a Ted Bundy, where his he had a full on girlfriend and she never knew. Right. It's not like that.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, so Cameron had kidnapped Marlowe's with the full intention of making her his sex slave. At one point, Cameron attempted to cut Marla's vocal cords so he could no longer hear her screaming, but gave up when she began bleeding too heavily. She would eventually die from the wound to her neck.
Yeah, from Cameron, the amateur surgery.
Yeah. Cameron what? Also strangled Marla's with a rope and hung her unclothed from a ceiling beam in the basement with a pillowcase over her head. She was dead at that point.
Oh.
The couple drove with Marla's body 30 miles north on Interstate 5, then Highway 44, east towards Lassen Park, where they dispose of Marla's body, burying her in a shallow grave. So I want you to remember Interstate 5 and Highway 44, because that will come up again.
Okay.
He then burned all of her clothing and belongings. So Janice has finished her story. Detective Shamlin says that Cameron kidnapped Marla's, killed her, and buried her all within a span of about 12 hours. So this is all happening rather quickly.
Oh, yeah.
He obviously made a mistake trying to cut her vocal cords because his intention was not to kill her. I think that his intention was to hold her for a much longer time. And this is confirmed later. During Janice's initial interview, she recounts another kidnapping in May of 1977. A year after Marla's disappeared. A woman named Colleen Stan was hitchhiking through town when Janice and Cameron abducted her, forced her into the car, put the head box on her, and Cameron kept her hostage for 7 years in the basement, torturing her and committing a multitude of sex crimes.
That's awful.
It's important to note here that at the time of Marla's abduction in 1976, Janice was only 17.
Oh, wow.
So doesn't that kind of change? Like, she was 16 when she married Cameron, who I believe was in his 30s.
Yeah, well, she was 16 when she married Cameron. Afraid of him.
And that's kind of what they rest their whole case on, is that she was afraid of him, right?
And that's why she like lawyered up.
Exactly.
Stuff.
Yeah. I think the fact that she was made this confession in a church, it tells me a little bit like she was just terrified that he was going to find her.
Yeah.
So this makes more sense to me now as to how she was so complicit.
She grew up enough, or maybe had worked up enough courage, or had enough years to realize this isn't like normal. This isn't what life's about.
Exactly.
Your husband's not supposed to do this.
Yes, exactly. So it makes more sense to me how she was so complicit in the crimes against Colleen and Marla's. She was understandably terrified of her husband and his dark proclivities, you know?
Right.
She was also in the midst of an ethical crisis. I mean, she's coming into her own as a woman, let alone she's got to deal with all this crazy shit. It's like, she doesn't know what's right and what's wrong.
Right.
Janice decides she's going to leave Cameron 7 years after Colleen's abduction. And Colleen actually is just like, take me with you. So she convinces Janice to help her escape, essentially. Mm-hmm. And Colleen actually comments on the episode. They interview Colleen.
Wow, so Colleen didn't die.
No.
Like, Colleen survives.
So Janice, what Cameron's just at work. It's kind of like a non-event, honestly, their escape. So Cameron is at work one day, and Janice takes Colleen, brings her home, and then Janice goes to her parents' house and hides there for a while before 3 months later going to the police.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it's like, they were captive, but only through their own fear.
Correct. Very similar to the Cleveland.
Yeah.
Girls.
Like, he must have been tormenting them and being like, if you leave, I'll find you and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But then he never did. He just.
Well, Janice even describes like multiple instances, even just during the 12 hours of Marla's abduction, mutilation, and murder eventually, is like, she was hesitant to be involved at multiple points, and he threatened her with violence or with various means of aggression. I don't know. And
threats.
Intimidation. Yeah, exactly. So Janice had convinced Colleen to not say anything to the police. Right. And Colleen was equally terrified of Cameron, obviously. So she keeps Colleen quiet, and Colleen tells small amounts to her family, which I can imagine how much it's killing them that they don't know what's going on or where she's been for 7 years.
For 7 years, yeah.
And Janice then eventually reports the crime, at which point police meet up with Colleen and their stories line up completely. So Colleen could give little information about Marliz other than her recollection of a photo that Cameron had in the house that she had seen. When she describes the photo to police, they confirm that the photo was of Marliz. The entirety of both cases relied heavily on Janice's cooperation. Police asked Janice to direct them to where Cameron had buried Marliz's body, but they failed to locate the body, and the DA determines that they did not have enough to try Cameron for Marliz's homicide, and Cameron Hooker has vehemently denied Janice and Colleen's claims. They didn't have physical evidence, and they didn't have Marliz's body, so they had they didn't have enough evidence.
They didn't have enough proof.
Right. But they were able to try him for the crimes against Colleen.
Yeah.
So they make the difficult decision to try Cameron for the kidnapping and rape of Colleen Stan and put Marliz's case on the back burner. Colleen recalls the realization she had that the less she screamed and fought Cameron during her captivity, the less excited he became and the shorter the duration of the sexual torture. Because as a sexual sadist, he got off on her fighting and pleading, being hurt, and whatever, that, and being hurt. Yeah, exactly. So the more she could grit her teeth and bear it, the shorter it would be.
Yeah, okay.
It's so sad. The prosecutor and Colleen were actually forbidden from mentioning anything about Marliz during the trial because it wasn't relevant and he wasn't on trial for that crime.
Okay.
As much as they wanted to bring in, oh, and also he killed this girl in 1976, they couldn't because that's not what he was on trial for.
Right.
Colleen recalls what the judge said during Cameron's sentencing hearing, that Cameron was the most dangerous psychopath he had ever dealt with, and that he believed Cameron would be a danger to women as long as he was alive. Cameron Hooker was convicted on 10 counts and sentenced to 104 years in prison. Marliz's murder was an open case, but not active because there was still a lack of leads and no body had been discovered.
Right.
In April of 2000, when Jody and Hannah moved out of apartment 14, life seemed to return to normal. But in 2008, Jody begins to have weird dreams again. So this is 8 years after they've left the apartment.
Right.
In the new dream, Jody had an aerial view of the couple, same as before, a tall man and a short woman who appeared to be stalking or searching for somebody. A series of numbers and letters appear over and over in the dreams. She says like bursts of light, almost like a jumbotron or something like that, right?
Uh-huh.
And she says 35.76 kept showing up and A17, and they kept showing up again and again in the dream.
God.
Jody suspected that the information That's might lame. Help someone, so she
That's
called
so weird.
The Red Bluff Police Department. Just wait, man, it's so weird. I'm almost done. Police were understandably shocked that Jody was calling. However, she assumed this was because they didn't believe her, when in fact Red Bluff police had just reopened Marliz's case that morning.
Oh my gosh.
The police officer told Jody that he, quote, had never been so freaked out.
Yeah.
Because she said she had been having these dreams for months. And then one morning she woke up with this feeling. She's like, I have to call police today. Like she had this feeling. So she calls police. Detective Hale is understandably skeptical, but willing to listen to Jody. She gives the numbers to the police, and in their investigation, they confirm that there is a road that connects Interstate 5 and Highway 44, known as Access Road 17, or on a map, A17.
Yeah.
Fucking insane. And if you remember, girlfriends, Interstate 5, they drove north on Interstate 5 and east on Highway 44 to dispose of Marliz's body.
Right.
Thanks to the information provided by Jody and Janice, police, they have further narrowed down the search area to Lasser Park, but Marie Elizabeth Spanicki's body has never been found. Now, if you remember, the number Jody gave police was 35.76, and girlfriends, you may be wondering what that number means. Police later would discover that the distance from Cameron and Janice's home in Red Bluff to the designated search area was 35.76 miles.
Wow, that's so weird.
Okay, technically it was 35.77, the detective says. But that's 1/10 of a mile off from the number in Jody's dream.
No, that's 1/100 of a mile.
One hundredth. I'm not Matt. I don't do math.
It's fine.
1/100th
like,
of a mile.
That's like 50 feet off.
Yeah. So.
Which is like, weird.
Isn't that fucking crazy?
Why does this all sound like fabricated, but it's real?
It's insane. Yeah. And it's actually like on the show, and this show is so thoroughly investigated before they like, because psychics are on the show all the time, right?
Yeah.
Because on any time a case is cold for a long time, you get all these weirdos coming out of the woodwork and they're like, hey, I know where this woman is buried, blah, blah, blah. But
yeah.
I think the fact that she was so, like the case had been cold for almost 25 years when she first made contact, I guess, with Marliz and started having these dreams. And then like didn't even know for sure that this girl had died until like the early 2000s. It was like 2006, I think, is when she first heard about the article and saw the picture. And even then, those numbers didn't show up until 2 years after that. And it wasn't until 2010 that police were able to do anything with those numbers. So it wasn't even until 2010 that Jody found out that the information she gave even helped them. She was like, I feel called to give you this information. I don't know what it means. I hope it's relevant. And they were like, thanks, we'll call you.
Yeah, but they also didn't find anything
for 2 years. Yeah, but they were able to narrow down the search area.
Able to narrow it down to, but Janice had already told them that it was at the Lassand Farm or Lassard Park. Lassard Park.
Yeah, but I think the fact that this Jody's story was helpful in a number of ways. One was that it corroborated Janice's testimony, which I think, you know, Janice being close to the primary suspect is, you know, her testimonies can be dubious. Like they should be skeptical about it.
Right.
But so I think one, they were able to corroborate her story. And two, she was able to talk about like, they were able to narrow down the range because she gave specific numbers and described features along the road that Janice, after 24 years, could not recall.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, no, it's still super interesting.
So weird. Marliz's homicide case remains open with the Red Bluff Police Department. Cameron Hooker was granted parole.
Why?
And is awaiting release pending a mental health evaluation of his classification as a sexually violent predator. I guess good behavior. Hmm. When you're in a prison with all men and you're a sexual sadist with a tendency to attack women, obviously you're going to be on good behavior.
Yeah, there's no women around.
Right. Marliz's sister remains hopeful that one day her sister's story will come to an end and she will finally be able to rest in peace, getting the justice she deserves.
Yeah, I wish they could find her.
Yeah, me too. So if you have any information on Marliz's disappearance, it is understandable, though. Contact the Red Bluff Police Department.
Yeah, yeah. Of course. Call Crime Stoppers.
Yes.
It does make sense a little bit, though, that Janice doesn't necessarily recall everything all about where they took her. Because as a 17-year-old lady, or even a 17-year-old in general, I don't know if you'd know exactly where to go.
Yeah.
As far as directions was.
She was 17... And then she was able to, I mean, but with her age, with the stress of what they were in the middle of doing.
That's what I'm saying. Right? And it was also 8 years later, like, how did she know that how far they walked or drove back into the woods?
Exactly. Yeah. And so I think it's just, they even show the meeting of Jody and Detective Hale, the guy from Red Bluff Police Department. They even they filmed their meeting after 2 years of Jody giving the initial report on the 35.76. And we actually get to see Jody finding out that it was helpful information and like it meant something. And that was really cool.
Tune in next time to the next dream she has.
Yeah, exactly. God, they're going to solve and find out who killed Kennedy.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay, but wow.
That's super cool. I like that.
So it feels like I was talking forever, but we were bantering for like 30 minutes technically, right?
Yeah, no worries. It is super interesting how I really didn't know what was going on because it started off with like the haunting stuff. And then we kind of like took a turn into like, that was this lady's apartment.
Was it easy to follow?
Yeah. Okay, I liked it.
Good.
I think it's a treat. Sure.
It was kind of all over. I wanted to give you a little of everything.
Yeah, it was cool.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm ready to hear. This is part three of Waco, the Waco siege, right?
Yes. So this is part three of the siege of Waco, the Mount Carmel facility, where the Branch Davidians, led by David Koresh, are encircled by the FBI and the ATF. The FBI has rolled in with their HRT team, the hostage rescue team, and they've taken over the situation. Where I left you last time was shortly after the first day, where the initial raid happened, where five of the Davidians had been killed, and several men were wounded, including David Koresh, and that the ATF, four people were killed and 16 were wounded. So, deaths on both sides, some bloodshed, and now we're in the negotiation phase, where the FBI has stepped in because federal agents had died, and David, they've just cut the phone lines, basically, and encircled Mount Carmel. And they basically, like, ran a phone line up to him to where they could talk to him.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going through the next couple days of the siege at this point. This is probably going to be a part four as well, ghoul friends, because there's so many things that happen over the 51 days that they're in a standoff. Crazy.
I had no idea it was that long.
And we'll kind of touch on why this is different from Jonestown and other things, other sieges and other things like that, because there is a reason, and it has to do with the Branch Davidians. But we'll go ahead and get into it. I've got a couple bullets here. Over the next couple of days, now from what I'm referencing is the days after the raid, Koresh would be talking to the FBI through negotiator agents for hundreds of hours of recorded conversations, and all those are posted online. Some of them are short, some of them are long, some of them don't make sense. Some of them are just like housekeeping things, talking about like how he's doing and stuff like that. But for a while, the David Koresh and some of the other Branch Davidians would get on and talk to the negotiators. David would talk to the negotiators about his family and the Bible, and would ask them about the negotiator's family and get to know them. And, you know, hundreds of hours of phone conversation, because what do you do when you're cooped up and
for 51 days,
the FBI is like just encircled you in a standoff. Like you're under siege. It just reminds me of, like, think about a medieval castle. Like they're just waiting for everyone on the inside to starve.
Yeah.
Basically.
That's fucked, man.
I
wonder if they were getting... Now, granted, this is a compound, so they probably got tons of food stores and stuff like that, don't you think?
Yeah. And that's what I'll say. But for a while, you know, for the next couple of days, the Branch Davidians and the FBI would exist in a stalemate in the siege, as you will, standoff, while the negotiations were taking place. And for the negotiators, it was hard to comprehend why the Branch Davidians were not just coming out with their hands up, surrendering, turning over the children based upon the allegations of child abuse. But the FBI couldn't really comprehend that. The Davidians, however,
they
were not...
They couldn't comprehend
why they were just waiting. Or sitting inside, accepting the new normal.
What they were waiting for.
What they were waiting for, why they were all holed up. They didn't really understand why David Koresh was like, we'll just sit here under siege because we haven't done anything wrong. But according to the Branch Davidians, they're not your typical doomsday cult where the end of the world meant salvation immediately. Or like just wide sweeping, like a bomb drops.
Like a rapture.
The Lord comes, you're raptured, whatever. For the Branch Davidians, the end of the world was to be prepared for and to defend against the final trial or the war before they are saved. Like they're supposed to hold out, right?
Oh, Okay.
Because that's their whole thing. The reason why they have this facility is because they want to be self-sufficient. They want to be prepared for the end of the world with guns to defend themselves, with provisions stockpiled to help make sure that they can last a siege.
So they're more like apocalypse preppers.
Kind of like a mix between like a doomsday prepper and like a religious cult.
But they're not a doomsday cult in the way that like Heaven's Gate was, where they just think the world's going to end in like a split second and we're going to be saved if we all commit suicide.
No, from their beliefs, it's like, this is when shit hits the fan. Like, the government fails, everyone turns on us, and, you know, we as the 144,000 are going to, you know, ride out with Jesus at the end of the trial or whatever.
How many Branch Davidians are there at this point?
There are around 120. And I'll have a concrete...
smaller than I thought.
Yeah, but it's like the compound, the facility they're in is like two stories. It's big. So there's like a lot of people.
It's definitely not 144,000.
No.
Right. Well, I knew it wasn't that big, but.
No.
That's a lot. Okay.
I'm referencing the 144,000 from Revelation. Okay. They're part of that. Where the rest of that large number is, I don't know. I don't think David Koresh was asked that question.
Okay.
The Branch Davidians and David Koresh had many conversations with the FBI. The FBI negotiators tried to explain why they would not come out and surrender. That's a terrible sentence. What I'm trying to say is, basically, the FBI probed a lot of the Branch Davidians, and they talked to David Koresh, and through those many conversations, they tried to understand why they would not come out and surrender. Because the FBI doesn't know, you and I know, but the FBI doesn't know why the Branch Davidians are prepared and what they are prepared for. They just know that they have guns and they're not coming out and surrendering. And David Koresh is saying things like he's going to protect his family, all these things, which sounds very like Second Amendment-esque. But really what it is he's going to protect his family from the doomsday, from whatever trial they have to survive in order for salvation to come.
So they don't realize that, as far as the Branch Davidians are concerned, this is the end of the world.
Yes, they don't realize that.
They just have to hang on long enough until God comes and saves them.
Right. They don't realize that that is the, like, what the Branch Davidians are kind of not hoping for.
Right.
But, like, in their doctrine, in their teachings, in David Koresh's mind, they don't realize that they're fulfilling a prophecy, so to speak.
Okay. Yeah. Which seems like it could be accomplished with a conversation, but maybe.
Could be, but I don't know why they're not really getting it, because, and I'll talk about that, but the FBI assumed that the Branch Davidians were just like every other doomsday cult.
Yeah.
And they treated their situation in the same way that they had before, whether it was Ruby Ridge, whether it was Jonestown that happened recently, how they were trying to learn from that. Mm-hmm. They just wanted to treat it all the same because they thought that people were just going to come out guns blazing, or they were just going to drink the Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
So they were like, yikes. At this point, the FBI's like, when is it going to happen? When's the big thing going to happen? And the Branch Davidians are just like, well, this is our new life.
God, it must have cost hundreds of millions of dollars in like manpower and work hours. And I mean, like, and weapons. I can't even believe how expensive this operation must have been.
Yeah, it was kind of military mobilization with tanks and everything else.
Like recon and helicopters. Like all of that stuff that leads up to it too. Although it doesn't sound like a ton of planning went into it. I don't know.
No, on the ATF side, I don't think it was planned very well.
51 days, that's wild.
Yeah. The more things. Let's see. So they assumed like they were just like every other cult. But the Branch Davidians were accepting the FBI siege as the new normal or the final trial before salvation, which is what we were kind of talking about.
Okay,
they were kind of fulfilling their own prophecy is a good way to put it. The Branch Davidians had enough stockpile provisions to get them through the world ending. So they hunkered down and waited for the FBI's next move over the next couple days. So, and that's what the FBI couldn't understand.
Yeah.
Like, what are they hiding? What are they doing?
Yeah.
Eventually, David Koresh said that he had a message for the American people, and that if they played it on the news, that he would willingly surrender to the FBI.
Oh, it's a big deal.
The FBI played David's message. If you want to find it, it's just kind of like 4 minutes of rambling. There wasn't a lot of
That was his only condition, though?
Yep. That if they played message to American people. What it was typically is like...
That's a cult leader.
And I think they edited a little bit of it, or maybe they didn't, but it was like, hey, you know, we didn't shoot first. Apparently, they shot first. Apparently, somebody shot, and that was the signal, whatever. And then he talks a lot about, like, if someone broke into your home and was trying to kill your family, what would you do?
It's fucking sketchy that they edited it. That's fucked.
I don't know if they did or not, but I imagine they could have. Because they cut the phone lines and everything, so I don't know if David would even hear it.
There's no way that they did it. They just, I mean, they probably just, I don't know. They could easily trick him.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
But, so they played it. They played David's message over the news. Okay. However, David told the FBI that God had decided that he was not to leave yet. So David stayed inside the compound.
So he tricked them.
Basically. God told him not to leave, so he was like, all right, cool, we're going to stay.
Yeah.
The FBI was questioned at a press conference on whether or not the FBI believes that David Koresh was talking to God. The FBI basically said that David Koresh believes that he is talking to God, but we don't believe that David Koresh is talking to God.
We believe that he believes that he's talking to God.
Well, they don't. They just think that David Koresh is
right, that's what I'm saying.
Crazy, or being a cult leader.
We believe that he believes it.
Yeah. Right. Which, maybe if they started, instead of saying all these things, and I don't know if the Branch Davidians can see the news coverage of all this, but maybe if they were to be like, okay, well, we'll play into David Koresh. He talks to God.
Yeah.
We know he talks to God. David, over the negotiations, you talk to God. What does God say, David? How are we going to get through this? You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't know if any of that happened in the manuscript. I didn't read all the way through it. But I feel like the FBI makes things difficult because they're trying to discredit David Koresh, but it might have helped to gas him up or believe along with Koresh to smooth over the negotiations.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to... The last thing you want to do with this man you suspect of having all these weapons is piss him off.
Yeah, well, and there's women Seems and children like, still inside.
Right.
Not only for the safety of those people inside, but the safety of people outside.
Exactly.
Okay,
exactly.
But, now, meanwhile,
re-say that.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, so while David Koresh was talking to negotiators and sending the messages to the American people, the FBI was continuing to kind of mess with the Branch Davidians. Doing things like driving their tanks up to the front door and like ramming the front door and cutting the power lines to the facility and basically shutting all the power off to the whole facility. And on one account,
trying to drive them out.
Yeah, well, they're messing with them. Like,
it's fucked.
Why would you want to come out of there when people are like driving tanks into your walls and like, God, you know, cutting the power and messing with you?
Our tax dollars at work.
Yeah, on one account, from the Branch Davidians, the agents surrounding the Mount Carmel facility were mooning the Branch Davidians, looking out the windows, sometimes specifically mooning the women. So you can imagine.
Can I react to that again?
Yeah.
That's kind of fucked.
It's messed up.
Yeah.
It's just like you see a lady in a window and you're like, I'm going to pull my pants down. It's like the sawed off humans that were encircling this place, just
God damn
wonderful people with tanks, basically.
What's wrong with people?
I don't know. And so you can imagine the women who have children and who are not accustomed to being mooned all the time or having tanks driven into their walls. You can imagine that they didn't want to surrender or hand over their children to the FBI because of all the torment, which is what the FBI was trying to negotiate.
Because they were like, maybe if I show her my butt, she'll give me her kids.
Yeah, yeah.
That's insane.
It's weird. The negotiators, like the FBI negotiators, asked David, since he would not be leaving the facility, if he could send some of the children out. Because that was this whole thing. You know, he's a child abuser. Let's get the children out, and then we'll go in there and we'll get him. You know?
Yeah, they're both worried about the children. Meanwhile, they all have their guns threatening children. So I don't...
Right. They're driving tanks. They're cutting the power off, so people freeze. Like,
even David Crush is like, he claims to be worried about the children, but then he has allegations of child abuse, and he's fucking staying in there when he knows all the government wants is him.
Yes. So, and that's the other thing, is I think David Koresh believes in himself as well.
Oh,
what I mean by that is, like, he doesn't want to go out because he says, like, if he walks out, he's like, what is going to happen to the people I care about, the people inside? What's going to happen to everybody else?
You have to be a lot of egomaniac to run a cult.
Right. But
I know what you're saying.
I still think he's sort of concerned about, like, okay, if I walk outside, what happens to me is one thing, but what happens to my children and their mothers and my wives and my friends and everything else? I'm sure everybody's just not going to get their own little house outside the compound. Like, they sounds like they might get mistreated. And from the people that are surrounding the Mount Carmel facility, mooning people and people have actually killed each other.
Understandably,
it's weird.
It's an understandable concern.
But yeah, what?
I have an alternate take on it. I think that I believe that that's what David Koresh is projecting, is that he is worried about their safety if he were to leave and get arrested, right? What I think is in actual fact, he believes that he's the key to this organization, and that if you remove him, the entire thing will fall apart because they will all turn on him because he's been abusing them and controlling them for a number of years. I would say that he feels that if his position is threatened, then the organization is threatened because he believes he is the organization, right?
Right.
And if you take him out, they're all going to fucking turn on him.
Yeah, and that's why there's a part four, because there's a lot of discrepancies on all the evidence.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah, no, it'd be really weird. They're all
like, we've eaten David Koresh. We're coming out with our hands up.
It's so convoluted, which is why we're having to like go back and forth and all this. But it's good that you're seeing that as well, because I also think that David Koresh could just be scared and selfish at that point. Because if he leaves, then he doesn't have hostages. And then they could do whatever they want to him. Yeah. Beat him up. So he might... Yeah. I'm thinking that David Koresh might even be a little bit of a coward in that case.
A narcissist.
Because if he's all they want, then turn yourself in.
Yeah.
So.
Which he is what they want. I mean, they're like... Yeah. So, anyway. Ugh.
So, I'm going to continue to muddy the waters.
Okay.
Because things are... They're just so... It's so weird.
Yeah.
David said, after the negotiation, the negotiators asked him to send some of the children out, David said he would be happy to send people who didn't want to be there. Now, several mothers, I didn't know how many, but several, I would imagine, you know, less than five, several mothers and 19 children ages 5 months to 12 years, so 19 children, left when David let the people that wanted to leave go. So he went around and he asked, okay, if you want to leave, there's the door. And around about 23 people left. This meant that there were still 23 or so children left inside the compound, and that in total, counting the children, the 23 children, there are 98 people left in Mount Carmel after these people leave.
Say that again?
The mothers and the children. So after the mothers and the children that didn't want to be there left, there's only 98 people.
Okay.
And in those 98, there was 23 children left.
Okay.
So not all the children left.
Okay.
And not all the mothers left. So the women and children are still inside Mount Carmel, but some of them left.
So these are just the people who didn't... maybe this was David Crush's way of weeding out his disloyal followers. I don't know.
Yeah, or the people who were like freaking out, like, we trust our government, so let us go. Or we think you're weird, let us go.
I just remembered the fucking reporter who's like, which way to the siege, please? And he was...
Excuse me, sir. Which way is the siege today?
Extra.
And the guy was like, a siege? I didn't know there was going to be a siege. He said, yes, yeah. The siege on Mount Carmel. He's like, I live in Mount Carmel. Oh, balls.
I live there.
The anonymous tip. Love it.
That's so funny.
The mothers that left the compound, and so here's kind of a good reason. The mothers that left the compound were separated from each other and their children, and then all the mothers were arrested. The children were separated and interviewed for information. So keep in mind that the media's coverage or the angle on the siege of Mount Carmel is that the FBI is trying to save all these children from child abuse, and that the Branch Davidians and especially David Koresh are monsters. Okay. So that's kind of the spin on all this in order to keep people okay with this happening.
Right.
So during the interviews with the children, the FBI asked the children from the Branch Davidians about child abuse. And I don't think any David Koresh's children left, but of the children that did leave, they were like, did anyone abuse you? And at the time of the standoff, it was 100% true. Like, there was no doubt through the interviews with the children that all of the children said that there was child abuse. Children ages from 5 months to 12 years old. The ones that could comprehend, they said that they had been abused, either by their parents or by David Koresh.
And you guys, children do not lie about that stuff.
Yes.
They don't.
However, there was no evidence or records or logs of the children testifying about the child abuse that they allegedly experienced at Mount Carmel.
Are you kidding me?
No one took a video. No one recorded the conversations. So did they interview the children?
Oh, I see what you're saying.
According to the people who were present for the interviews, later testified that there was zero evidence that child abuse was present and that the FBI was asking leading questions to the children.
Fuck. Which that's really easy to do, to trick a child into thinking something is true.
Exactly. It's like, children don't lie.
Hello, Santa Claus.
Unless you kind of coerce them into saying things. You can manipulate children very easily, but children don't lie if they're going to come out and say it to you first.
Yes.
But if you lead them in down a path of, you know, admitting something, they can't.
And actually, this happens in divorce trials a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, like, when they're trying to throw out allegations to the other person to get custody, they'll get the child to say something.
Right.
Yeah. So I guess I understand what you're saying.
Further muddying the waters.
Yeah.
Because even though there was not evidence, the story that was being broadcasted by the FBI and the media was that not only Koresh was abusing the children, but that he and the parents were doing it together. And not only that the abuse happened in the past, but that the parents and Koresh were now actively abusing and torturing the children during the standoff. Like, they were just like beating the children up,
like,
and that's
right
why they
now.
Were there.
Yeah.
To justify them like being there.
Oh, man. That's so sketchy.
It is weird. It's like controlling the narrative too much.
Yeah.
It's like, maybe not tell us all the gory details, but like still give us the truth. This sounds like we're lying in order to make these people out to be enemies so we can bomb them or something. I don't know.
Well, they're trying to justify what they're probably planning on doing.
Yeah, and so that's something that we'll get into as we go along. But the days drug on, and the FBI was starting to fight internally about what is the best course of action, because the negotiators always needed more time to talk to the Branch Davidians. However, the HRT team, more of your action types, said that the negotiations were going too slow, and that the HRT was going to speed it up a little bit.
Oh, God.
So you can imagine how tactful this is going to be.
Right.
So how do you speed up negotiations? Well, the HRT said that psychological war would probably be a really good way to doing this.
Oh.
So they started to mess with the Branch Davidians a little bit. So they started demolishing the cars parked out front by just running over all of the things parked out front with tanks. So they just took a tank and they just ran it over and just like, like monster truck style, just like just demolishing everything in the yard and,
around
the facility where the people were holed up at. So it's like turning everything into a wasteland, destroying everything they own.
My God.
Just crazy things like that. But it gets worse.
You're the cheating boyfriend. You like wreck his car.
Yeah, this took a Louisville slugger to both headlights.
Okay, go ahead.
Ran over his car with my tank.
Uh-huh.
Maybe he'll think again before he cheats.
Throw my tank into
the side of it.
Four-wheel drive. Throw my name into his leather seat. I used to think it was legacy. That's what it sounds like.
Carve my name into his legacy? That sounds...
It's very poetic, right?
Sounds wild and very metaphoric.
Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, so they just started breaking everything they own, which I'm sure there's a problem with that. Like,
right.
I mean, if you go and smash someone's mailbox, it's property damage, but when the ATF does it, it's fine.
It's sanctioned. It's very
it's a
like,
negotiation tactic.
Very like kindergarten playground conflict management.
It is weird. And there was a lot of things that I say a lot of things, but there was an instance of one of the Branch Davidians who was talking to the negotiators, basically saying that like the people who were surrounding them, he said the actions of the people outside versus the actions and the demeanor and the attitude of the people on the phone during negotiations. He said there's a huge difference. He said people outside the compound are mooning us, you know, flipping us off. They're running over our cars with tanks. Meanwhile, you on the inside are saying, you know, all you guys need to do is surrender and come outside and everything will be okay. And it's like, meanwhile, like crazy crap's happening outside. Why would we want to step outside?
It's like the hostage negotiators on the phone, and then the ATF guy is in the background going like,
just thrusting. Yeah.
Oh God.
Thrusting and like people are like peeking out the windows. It's like you're hostage negotiating, looking out the window, and all of a sudden someone shoots through the window, and you're like, okay, this is not a negotiation. This
There's
is
a
bad.
Guy over the hostage guys.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like we're cooperating. Like... Yeah, basically, like they hold up a big sign that's just like a kid being like shot or something. Like, or
we're
like,
lying.
It's a stick figure of a guy with a gun holding another guy like, on his knees. And it's like this. He's like Branch Davidians over this one. ATF over this one.
This is
behind
you.
The guy on the phone. Like, come on out.
Yeah, it's fine. Come on. This will be you.
So yet another reason why the Branch Davidians didn't want to come out, and they definitely didn't want to be like, all right, my son.
Yeah.
Go outside to the man that's right. Mooning your mom every single time she wants a breath of fresh air.
Yeah, you don't greet the mom mooner.
Yeah.
It's a sick.
He's like sick Dad, DJ, I don't want to like go to DJ the man. Name? I've seen his butt.
DJ name? Mom Mooner.
Mom Mooner. or a band name Mooning Moms.
Oh yeah, I need to add it to my list.
There you go.
Hold please.
So.
Well, I guess you go ahead. I'm just.
Adding, oh no,
I'm
that's
adding
fine.
It to my band list.
It's fine. No, we'll wait.
No, go.
We'll wait till you type it into your phone. But anyway, no, I keep
going. Oh.
So. More psychological things that they were doing. Through the nights, they would shine spotlights to the windows and play disturbing noises over the loudspeakers.
What does that mean?
Well, it's just examples like... include... Yeah. You're closer than you think. They would play like 50s era music or like old music with the sounds of like rabbits being killed.
Oh God!
Like cut throughout the song. It's like in the background, you just like hearing like, I don't know, a 50s song.
Rabbits
I'm
scream,
blanking.
By the way,
that's what I'm saying.
Oh,
it's like weird. It's like the music's fine, but in the background or in the silences, it's just like a rabbit dying, and you're like, what?
Oh, under the boardwalk. We'll be falling in love on another boardwalk.
Yeah. Yeah, with the rabbit just getting demolished. Or they would just play like dolphin noises just over and over and over again.
I can't. Can you make a
dolphin in the middle of the night? I can't, but we can all hear it. It's just channel Sponge. Yeah, channel SpongeBob, like when they curse.
That sounded like fucking Ozzy.
Timestamp.
No, like Crazy Train.
Oh. But yeah, no. It sounds like Hell Week for fraternities. Like where they just beat you up, throw you in a room, God, put a bag on your head.
No kidding.
So when questioned by the media about the psychological warfare tactics, the FBI spokesperson said, I don't know what psychological warfare is.
Psychological warfare?
That's just what they said.
They said they didn't know what it was?
He was like, I don't even know what that is. Which is so weird.
What a weirdo.
I know.
Playing dumb. That's grade A training right there, man.
Yeah, so the psychological warfare and everything started happening. That's where I'm going to kind of call it for this one, too, because at this point, we're now getting to a climax. The psychological warfare starts to wear on the Branch Davidians, as well as you now know that the HRT team is like, all right, tired of sitting here doing nothing. So they start progressively getting more and more violent, and things starting to heat up pretty quickly.
Ooh.
Yeah. Man, and then
that's crazy. I've made a deal not to watch documentaries or Google this. This was my unspoken deal with Trevor, because I was like, I know this story sort of well. I know of it, but I don't remember how it ends. I don't know.
Yeah.
Don't tell me.
I gotta wait for
part four.
Yeah, you'll have to wait for part four, but it's interesting how David Koresh has set up sort of like a self-fulfilling prophecy with the way that they've set up Doomsday. So true. And the way that it's happened to them, the way that the ATF has done what they've done, and the Branch Davidians, and how the standoff started. And now it's just like everything's just coming true that he's been talking about, and they can all, and if it's not 100% true, he can kind of spin it in that way of saying,
totally,
you know, these are the end times, this is what I've been preparing us all for, this is what we've stockpiled for. And
it's kind of like what Warren Jeffs did. Like, he said that in 1980, when the Olympics came to Salt Lake City, he was like, is that when 1980? I don't know. When the Olympic Games came to Salt Lake City, he was like, the world is going to end on that day. And then when it didn't end, obviously, he was like, well, this is God telling us that we've been saved and we're part of the 144,000. And so we need to move forth and multiply and occupy this town of Colorado Springs.
Right.
Yeah.
So. I see what you mean.
Colorado City. Just kidding.
Yeah.
Colorado Springs. Colorado Springs, I think, is the town in that movie Cars, the Disney movie.
Colorado
Springs. No, that's Radiator Springs. I don't know where Colorado Springs is. I just made it up.
I feel like Colorado Springs is probably a city.
It's probably a city. Yeah. Maybe it's bottled water. It sounds like bottled water.
Also, Salt Lake City Olympics were in 2002.
Yeah, well, like I said.
That was for the Winter Olympics.
What did I say, 1980?
Yeah.
Oh, God. I was way off. Let me see.
It probably was Summer Olympics.
Salt Lake City.
Oh, 1980.
Really?
Oh, Lake Placid. But that doesn't matter.
2002. Oh, I just hit my nail. It hurt. Yeah, it just says 2002. Damn it.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Okay, it was in 2002.
Yeah,
sorry, everyone. 1980. Oh my god, 1980 plus 22.
Yeah.
So that's it. You didn't let me finish.
I didn't. I'm sorry.
Wow. Well, that was a wild ride, man.
Yeah. Well, so, I'm hoping everybody's still sticking with me through this Waco stuff. I still think it's really cool.
I know, and I'm kind of...
This part four is going to be super conspiracy laden as well, because I've kind of been setting it up that, like, you know, is David Koresh a good guy and he's just right. portrayed as a bad guy? Right. Or was there evidence to support his badness?
Yeah.
So, yeah. So that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to muddy the waters real good. So you, mm-hmm. you don't know what, if you like him or hate him.
Yeah. No, it sounds good. Sounds good to me. Well, yeah. Ghoul friends, we wish you a Merry Christmas. No, just kidding. I said not it at yet. the right pitch that I was like, that sounds like right. the song. Okay, no, right. We are all done for today, I think. We are wrapping it up. It is late. Well, it's past my bedtime. I don't know about you, Trev. I'm tired.
It's about time to go to sleep.
I'm fucking exhausted. So
it's 3 a.m.
Hopefully you guys are listening to this in the morning when the ghost of Marliz is not going to freak you out. But I preemptively turned all my lights on and I will be watching The Office as I fall asleep, which is good. It's a scientific fact that The Office is the opposite of haunted houses.
Unless like you're watching like the Halloween where there's episode. Like,
no, like in a parallel universe where everything has like an opposite, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
This is it's The Office is the opposite of haunting. Of hauntings.
I got you. But it is soothing.
Cancels it out. Yeah, it is soothing. Yes. I've been rewatching it. That's been my COVID activity. And by the way, you can tell this is the longest I've talked since I have been sick because I'm losing my voice.
Yeah. You are losing your voice a little bit. You need to take a good nap.
I'll have a cup of tea and I'll go to bed.
Have a cup of tea.
Make some love. No, I'm just kidding. I just wanted to say it in that voice.
Oh, yeah, you're playing with your voice sounds now.
Yeah, nasty. Okay, anyway, you guys have the best day, and we will see you, hear you, talk at you, episode 46.
Yeah, and feel free to email us or send us any questions. Or yeah, it's okay. It's the outro.
It's been a while since we recorded, guys, so I'm out of touch. Okay, yeah. Yes. Email us at wheremurdermeetsmystery@gmail.com. And Trevor, where can they find us on Instagram?
I don't do Instagram, but it's like where murder meets mystery.
Yeah, you did it.
Yeah, but that's our handle. I don't know what that is. Is it at?
That's our handle. It's at where murder meets mystery. Yes, exactly. Oh, there you go. And have a great day.
Yeah, well, you should have a great day, but we're just gonna get out of here. Thanks for watching. I mean, not watching.
Fuck! I don't know. We are struggling.
Yeah, it's guys, late. Thanks for being here. Thanks for listening.
We're leaving. Okay, bye. Call your dad. Love you. Yep.